This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. There are a couple of ways to frame today's show. For those familiar with the phrase, we're checking in with the Cape and Islands' charismatic megafauna, some of the region's largest and most celebrated seasonal visitors of the non-human variety. Or in other words, turtles and right whales and sharks. Oh my! Later this hour, we'll get an update on how many cold-stunned sea turtles have been rescued from the shores of Cape Cod Bay this winter. We'll hear about the changing migratory habits of the endangered North Atlantic right whale and learn how climate change may be a factor in both. We start, though, with perhaps our newest celebrity sea creature, the great white shark. A new study finds these giants could live significantly longer than previously thought, maybe as long as 70 years. That research was part of Leiling Hamidi's doctoral dissertation. She recently received her PhD from MIT and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institutions. Congratulations, Dr. Hamidi, and welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Lisa Nattinson is a research fish biologist with the Northeast Fisheries Science Center in Narragansett. She provided the samples for this study, and she joins us now by phone. Welcome, Lisa.
Welcome. Thank you.
Okay, so Leiling, how much does this study change our understanding of how long sharks live? I mean, did we already knew they were slow growing and long lived. This though extends that lifespan, I guess.
Yes, significantly. Previous studies on white sharks had estimated their ages to be around in the mid 20s or so in terms of the maximum counted age. So this is quite an extension.
All right. So why is it important to understand how long white sharks live?
Well, it's important for several reasons. One of which is generally longer lived species tend to have later reproduction, and that is really important for conservation and management of species that are potentially overfished or endangered.
So, Lisa, how does information like this feed into fishery management? I mean, are we talking about primarily just in terms of regulating shark catch, or does this also feed into perhaps management decisions about other species?
Basically, for sharks, what we're looking for the management is the age at first reproduction and then the longevity, as Leiling had alluded to. And essentially that, along with reproductive information, how often they pup and how many they produce over their lifetime, helps tell us their productivity through the lifetime, and that can go into management equations for stock assessment. And then they can tell us how many are able to be removed from a population without harming the population.
So then are we thinking that with sharks, these white sharks potentially living up to 70 years, that they could be reproducing throughout their lifespan?
Well, sharks, they live late, long time, and they also reproduce later. So what this changes, it would change both numbers. And we're working on that. It's not a finished paper yet. But what we do with these validated ages is then produce a growth curve where we can determine age at maturity. And then we'll determine whether it changes anything from before. For example, before they thought they lived till they were approximately 22. Okay, so if they matured at 10 and lived till 22 and they reproduce every other year, then you have a certain amount of fecundity throughout the life, okay? If it turns out that they mature later now and they live later, it's going to depend on what the difference between maximum lifespan and maturity is to determine whether they are more or less productive.
So then how do we know when they mature? How is this equation, I guess, where is the unknown in this equation now if we know that they're living for a handful to several decades? Is this based on knowing how many pups came out and so they must be maturing later? Or do we need to pin down from a biological perspective when they mature so that we can figure out what the actual reproductive output might be?
It's exactly what you just said. That's it. There are several studies that combine to obtain this information. You have to do a reproductive study, find out when the males mature, when the females mature. And a species like the white shark, that's really difficult because we don't get the large mature ones. They obviously have to be dead for us to sample them. So a project like that takes a really long time. So we can only theorize from the few that have been found worldwide pregnant and what size they were and what size at maturity. So that, at this point, would be an estimate from other people's studies. And then the next phase in the, basically what the Li Lang study showed was when we age sharks, we use rings on their vertebral center. It's somewhat like a tree ring. But when they know a tree ring is deposited annually, we don't know that in a shark. So the Baum carbon study basically showed that up to a point, these bands can be counted as annual. Past that point, they can't be. So now we have to take that information and put it into our study of band counts on the 100 other white sharks that we have, and then come up with what's called a growth curve. And what that essentially is what age it is at what size. So then we get the reproductive information where it says the females mature at this size. We put an age to it, and then they can figure out the productivity in management.
So, Leiling, let's talk a little bit about what you actually did for this study. I mean, it sounds like basically what you're saying is that you know, with these growth rings, it's almost like the way that we grow very rapidly through childhood and adolescence, and then reach a point where growth essentially stops. That maybe we're seeing that same thing, that they slow down in putting these growth rings into their vertebrae once they reach a certain point.
Exactly. Yeah.
So how did you actually go about what did you use, and how did you go about actually figuring this out?
So growth rings in shark vertebrae have been used for a number of years. Their existence has been known for a number of years, and people have actually counted them for a while. And so what we did was, because the criteria has also changed in terms of, I mean, when you think of tree rings, people always think of the really nice pictures of tree rings where it looks very, very clear. And generally, when you look at pictures online or, you know, in papers from shark papers, it's the same thing. I mean, the pictures look very clear, and you're like, oh, okay, that's definitely a band.
It seems easier than, you know, when you see the textbook picture, nothing
exactly.
In real life is really that clean.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So it's actually a lot more difficult to tell what is and isn't a band. And that criteria has sort of changed over time, and as the method in terms of counting bands has also changed over time. And so one of the key things that you need to be able to do is to have some sort of outside method to validate what is an annual band. And so that's where the radiocarbon comes into play. And so what we did was we took these vertebrae and subsampled the rings. And so really what you do is you have a vertebrae, and it's circular, and you cut it in half, and then it's sort of like two bow tie shaped. If you look at the cut face, it looks like a bow tie. And you take a slice off of one of those faces, and it's a thin triangular shaped section, and the material gets laid down from the small pointy end of the triangle up to the wide end, and there are basically bands going across. And so what I did was I, under a microscope with a scalpel, I took subsections from the vertebrae and processed it for the Baum radiocarbon. And what we're doing is we are taking the amount of radiocarbon that is in the shark vertebrae and matching it up to a known reference chronology of the Baum radiocarbon spike from the ocean in which it lived in, to try and, you know, see if those band counts are, you know, if matching up those bands based on the band counts to the reference chronology, if that is...
If they match year to year.
Yeah, basically.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Leiling Hamadi and Lisa Nattinson, authors of a new study showing that white sharks may live as long as 70 years. Now, Leiling, let's go into this a little bit more. So you've got your shark vertebrae. First of all, how big are we talking about?
They're surprisingly small. I was very surprised when I saw my first one. I mean the largest ones, if you sort of like make a circle with your two hands, holding your fingers together, I mean, that's about the size of the largest one that I sampled.
So 4 or 5 inches maybe in diameter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you were talking about, you know, you cut it in half, you get your essentially triangle, and then you start cutting slices out of that correspond to these growth bands. How big is each one of those bands?
Because radiocarbon is actually the, you know, one of the rarest isotopes of carbon, you actually need a lot of material in order to run the sample. So I can't, most of the time, I can't actually subsample just just one band. So I'm sampling about like a millimeter of tissue at a time. So it's pretty fine, but you know, it could even be finer. I'm at the one sample at the terminal sample for the oldest shark, I actually shaved along a larger portion of the vertebra. I didn't take just the thin section in order to get a really, really fine sample of the material that was laid down just before it died.
And so that would be the 70-year-old.
Yes.
So yeah. Then explain, you've been talking about radiocarbon, bomb carbon. So where is the radioactivity in these vertebrae coming from, and how are you using that to figure out how old the cartilage is?
Okay, so radiocarbon is actually a naturally occurring isotope of carbon, but we are using bomb radiocarbon, which is slightly different in that it's an anthropogenic source. So there was thermonuclear testing in the 50s and 60s that put a whole bunch of this radiocarbon in the atmosphere above natural levels. And it was a very well-constrained, you know, time period. And then
there was just one burst of it and then it stopped.
Basically over a course of years. Yeah. And so it really creates there's really a spike. So if you look at the levels of radiocarbon, you know, before this thermonuclear testing, it was sort of like a flat line over decades. And then all of a sudden there's basically this straight up spike. And then because of the test ban treaty in 1963, we stopped putting this radiocarbon into the atmosphere, and the radiocarbon started to get mixed more and more into the ocean, which diluted the levels in the atmosphere. And so that has led to like a subsequent decline, and that's not actually due to, I mean, this is radioactivity, but the half-life is way too long for there to be any sort of decay. So really this sort of well-constrained spike period is the time that we need samples from in order to, you know, match up and determine the timing of the vertebral banding.
So then are you looking, it sounds like basically what you're trying to do is find where in that series of growth rings where that spike happened so that you can match up that date to that ring. Is that essentially what you're trying to do?
It's, so it's not just like a point, really. I mean, we have an idea of, you know, of what we think the age would be based on the counting the bands, and with that we create a curve from the vertebrae, and if it matches up to a reference chronology, then we know, you know, then we know that we're getting the counting correct. If it's off in some way, if it's shifted, if the shark chronology is shifted over to the left of the reference chronology, that means we're probably overcounting bands. And if it's shifted to the right of the reference chronology, that means we're probably undercounting bands. So that's really how it worked. The oldest female and the oldest male that we sampled were both shifted to the right of the reference chronologies, and so we were definitely undercounting the bands there and underaging them.
So then, Lisa, a lot of this, you know, is dependent on, of course, knowing exactly when that shark died, when the end of its life was. These had to be samples that you gathered. Talk about where you actually got vertebrae from white sharks, how you got those samples.
Well, as I mentioned, to get enough samples on a species like the white shark, where there aren't that many and there are not that many mortalities, our project's been going on since 1962, and so we have collections dating back that far, and those would come from incidental catches, fishermen, sport fishermen, and since the Apex Predators program's pretty well known along the coast, we would get calls from people catching white sharks. So then we would send one of our team over, and they would sample it for reproduction and vertebra. So we've had a collection and ongoing since 1962. And the other side of that is what enabled us to give Li Ling these samples, because there aren't that many fish that were alive during that bomb spike that she was referring to.
So I know you sometimes get samples from shark tournaments. None of these white shark samples came from tournaments, did they?
White sharks are not targeted anymore at all, of course. And in the past, when pre-protection and before 1993, when they were allowed to be caught, yes, there were a couple few that we did get from tournaments.
I wonder how you feel about actually using samples from tournaments. Obviously, this is a resource for your science, but is perhaps also could be seen as condoning the killing of sharks.
No, we don't really see it that way. Tournaments have been going on for a very long time, and they will probably always go on. As you can imagine, people like competition. These are all legal registered tournaments. The catches are all logged, and they're under the management process. So these are allowable takes that presumably our stock assessment personnel have factored into their assessments. So for us, or at least for me personally, if I didn't go to a tournament and these sharks were being landed and not sampled, that to me would be more of a waste than my being there and obtaining samples that I either cannot get otherwise or would have to get another way.
Now, Leiling, this is based on, this current study is based on a fairly small number of samples, both male and female sharks, and there was a pretty big difference between the oldest female and the oldest male sample. Do you think that's an actual biological difference? I believe it was the female, the oldest female you had was 40-something, the oldest male was that 70-year-old. Do you think that's an actual biological difference, or is that just an artifact of having looked at only a handful of animals?
I mean, at this point, we really don't have any idea. I would think that it's probably just an artifact of the limited sampling that we have at this point. There are definitely larger females that exist out there that we, you know, haven't been able to sample. So,
and in terms of, you just went back to the traditional method of counting the growth bands, there's no indication of a difference in lifespan between the males and the females.
At this point, I wouldn't be able to say. That would be something that Lisa would be able to answer a little bit better, I think.
Lisa, do you know, is there any indication of a difference in the lifespan of male and female sharks based on the ring counting method?
In many cases, in sharks, the female gets larger and presumably older than the males. But some of our new information is showing it's more similar. The females generally get larger because of the internal reproduction, of course. But in terms of the longevity, I would suggest that it's partially our sample size and the fact that we don't have any extremely large females that we could sample for this process. And we don't really get that many large females around here. So I can't say for sure whether this is true or not. I mean, that male could be an anomaly. We don't know.
Now, Leiling, what gave you the idea to actually pursue this as part of your research?
Well, I actually... Lisa can tell the story of the start of this project actually a little bit better than I can. In terms of interest, I was actually starting with basking shark vertebrae to begin with. But in terms of this whole process, yeah, Lisa knows the story.
So what was the switch from basking shark to white shark? Was it just availability of samples?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I think in terms of the the appropriateness of the samples that we have access to, yes. But in terms of the start, it was. I mean, I was originally interested in using these samples for stable isotope sampling to look at sort of feeding and movement behavior. And it's definitely key to know. To know the periodicity of when these bands are laid down in order to look at that information, to look over a lifetime of a shark.
So Lisa, the start of this project, I guess, goes back even before Leiling?
Yes.
Yeah, actually it goes back to that basking shark study. As I mentioned, we have a lot of vertebrae here, and Greg Scomo used to work in our project, and he was working with Simon on basking sharks. So they had asked me for some vertebrae, and at the time I was working on basking shark age, and I said, well, if you want the vertebrae for isotopes, that would be great, but how about doing me a favor and doing bomb carbon? And so they agreed to that, and then the next step was they came to me and said, well, now we're working on white sharks, why don't we do the same thing? And that was perfect. So I said, all right, I have enough white sharks to do an age study. If you want to see the bomb carbon, that would be great. And that's about when Leiling got involved and took over doing the actual project. So essentially it was, you know, a collaboration that they wanted the vertebra for their isotopes, and I needed it for my age and growth studies, and it became a collaboration between the state of Massachusetts, Woods Hole Oceanographic, and National Marine Fisheries Service.
And a win-win-win situation, it sounds
like. Absolutely.
Definitely.
It was great.
Now, I wonder, you know, you were saying started with basking sharks. We're now talking about white sharks. It sounds like this is a conundrum that spreads across all sharks, not just one species of sharks, about whether or not these growth rings really line up to annual growth.
Definitely.
Can we say from this study, does this result apply to other species that maybe the annual rings don't always match up, or do we need to go species by species and double check this?
We really need to go species by species. I mean, this is something that we've been finding in a number of different species. I mean, Lisa and I worked on dusky sharks and found that as well. And hopefully studies like this will sort of bring people out of the woodwork that may have these vertebrae that people can use to do this sort of ground truthing.
Now, Leiling, you've finished your doctoral dissertation, as we said, and I gather you are headed down to Washington, D.C., actually, to begin a policy fellowship. Will sharks be part of that? Did that idea kind of come out of this research and perhaps interaction with fish conservation, or is that something that goes back further?
It goes back further, and actually I'm not going to be working with sharks directly in this year. This coming year I'll be at the NSF Office of Polar Programs, but I do intend to continue to work on my dissertation chapters to write them up as papers, and it's something that's an ongoing passion of mine, so I'll definitely continue to look into, you know, shark conservation and shark ecology.
Dr. Leiling Hammadi of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, at least for a few more days. Dr. Lisa Natanson of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take a short break here, then chat with Dr. Stormy Mayo of the Center for Coastal Studies. Stay with us.